Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. Sunday, 21st of June, 2009. That makes this, what, the summer solstice, right? Yeah. Longest day and all that, yeah. Welcome to Solder Smoke 110. First, a little bit of Italy travelogue. We have been traveling around a bit, not too far from Rome. And one of the great things, one of the many, many great things about living in Italy, and especially this part of Italy, is that very close by, you can find all kinds of really wonderful places to visit. Within about an hour of Rome, you could be in the really kind of deep countryside. That's where we were yesterday. We were out at the summer home of some friends out in the northwest part of the province of Lazio. Lazio is the area that is the province in which Rome is located. It's central Italy, kind of the kneecap of the peninsula. And I'm telling you guys, just 1 hour out, and you're deep in the countryside, and I'm talking about a spectacular, amazing, beautiful mountainous countryside, castles up on top of the hills, beautiful little mountain towns, just a great place. So we were there yesterday, and the week before, we were out just across the border in the province of Tuscany, the famous, beautiful province of Toscana. Again, visiting friends near Grosseto, really beautiful area. So we've been pleased to be traveling around. We're going to be doing some more traveling now that the kids are out of school. Billy has graduated from primary school. We had the graduation ceremony on Friday. A lot of fun. Maria is out of school now too. We're very pleased. They're both going to be moving next year into the full Italian language program. They've been in the school that they attend. They're in the Italian as a second language program, ISL, and they've been doing so well with it and have been picking up so much Italian that they're going to spend next year not taking all of their classes in Italian, but when it comes time to take Italian class, they'll be kind of mainstreamed with the Italian kids, so studying whatever the Italian kids, the native speakers of Italian, are dealing with at that time. So we're really pleased that they're moving forward in Italian. Speaking of speech and speaking, I have discovered, gentlemen, that I am a victim. Not only am I a victim of the knack, but I am a victim of another disease that I didn't even know I had. I've been going on here for 50 years with this problem. Well, I guess 48 years. Ever since I started speaking, apparently I have been walking around with sibilant S disease. I didn't know this. I mean, I was only diagnosed as a result of you know, rambling on here on Solder Smoke. And the guy who made the diagnosis is our friend Jonathan, until recently of Tokyo, the guy who attended all those, that great ongoing radio flea market in Tokyo that I've never been able to pronounce properly, probably because of my sibilant S disease. You see, I'm a victim. We've had all kinds of discussions on Solder Smoke about how to clean up the audio, how to fix the audio, whether we need a new bike, whether we need equalizers, whether we need this program or that program. We probably need all those things. Don't get me wrong. But Jonathan is the one who put his finger right on the problem, who identified the problem. The problem is natural. It's in my voice. My S's whistle. They do. And I was never aware of it. He sent in an email and he said, he put it very kindly and he kind of hinted that this might help should I ever want to make a career move into bluegrass music. But he said that, yeah, my S's whistle. Now, I've been completely unaware of this, blissfully unaware of it. Not that it's really bothering me now, but I was blissfully unaware of it before. But after he sent me that email, I found myself listening to my S's. And, you know, he's right. Occasionally, there's a whistle in there. It's not my fault. There's kind of a weird thing going on here, too. Why I was not aware of it. And one of the reasons I probably was not aware of it is that I have a really bad combination of speaking and hearing problems because I have a really noticeable high-frequency hearing loss that can probably be blamed on some unfortunate early Army experiences on rifle ranges before the Army really got into earplugs and things like that. So anyway, I have this thing called, oh, here's another one I've got. I've got tinnitus. Ooh, the dread tinnitus. This constant ringing in your ears. Yeah. Anyway, I've got that too. But the tinnitus, you see, helps with the sibilant disease because you can't hear yourself whistling. So here we go. Anyway, I'm really glad that we finally got to the root of the problem. I'm going to try an experiment here. I understand that the microphone picks it up and that it's really kind of painful, especially when listening on an MP3 player with the headphones on. So what we're going to try to do this week is I'm going to try to roll off. I'm not going to put a notch in there. I think I'm going to roll off all the frequencies above about 3,000 hertz. It might make it sound a little bit more like I'm talking you through a Yaesu Icom Kenwood, you know, 3000X, something like that. I don't know, but we'll give it a shot. We'll see if that helps. I think that this problem especially becomes noticeable when I start describing our trips to places like Sicily. You got two whistles in there. So it's really, really urgent that we get this taken care of, and we'll do the experiment today, and I'll try to roll off the everything above 3,000 hertz, and we'll see if my S's are in there. All right. Speaking of speech processing, I've got a project that I want to ask you guys whether you think it's worth doing or not. It has to do with double sideband. You know, I'm a big double sideband fan. I've got my my Whisper double sideband transmitter. Let's see. Throw the switch. Okay, it's on. And who knows? I might be making it into a Johan's Grabber up there in Belgium right now. But in the more conventional DSB speech mode, not DSB Whisper, DSB speech, I built this 80-meter transmitter. I told you guys about it. I haven't used it too much. I haven't had a whole lot of success. My antenna for 80 meters is not all that great. And so I haven't really been getting out too much. It's sitting there. It's ready to go. It may be fired up from another location. But right now, it's not doing too much. One of the things that people have been telling me, especially and my friend John Franco, I0 Zulu Yankee, more about him in a minute. But he's been advising me that it would really be good for me to put some audio filtering into this rig, because when he listens to it or when he listens to any of my double sideband rigs, he says that it sounds really broad. Well, you know, on the one hand, he's right. It is doubly broad. It's double sideband there. But I think what he's talking about is when he's listening. And of course, he is with the conventional ham radio transceiver. He's listening only to one of the sidebands. The other one is just off out there, out of his passband, so it's not really affecting his receiving experience. But He says that even when listening to the one sideband, it does sound excessively broad. There was a QST article several years ago in the QRP Power column about how to use some simple speech processing to increase the effectiveness when using SSB at low power levels. If anybody knows what month that article came out, please let me know, because I think that's exactly what I need. Well, it may be close to what I need. The problem is that with most SSB rigs, the whatever audio processing gear that they come up with probably won't focus too much on the frequency issue, because the frequency range will be taken care of by the crystal filters in the SSB rig. Of course, I have no crystal filters in my DSB transmitters, so we're concerned here about not only the conventional clipping and maybe a little bit of compression, but also restricting the frequency range of the audio that gets to the balanced modulator. Obviously, one way to do this would be with a couple of RC filter op amps to really restrict the frequency range. I guess one at low pass, one at high pass, and kind of limit it to from 300 to 3,000 hertz, something like that. But I'm wondering if that would help. I kind of did a quick test to see the frequency range that was making it through my D104 microphone and 741 op amp speech amp that I already have in there. And I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of really high frequencies beyond 3,000 hertz making it in there now. So before I launch an unnecessary effort here, please let me know what you guys think, whether it's worthwhile to try to build these things. Also, I'm not too fond of building audio amps with little IC chips. It's really kind of a boring, I think, boring project. But if necessary, I'm willing to do it. Let's see what else we have here. All right. Minimalist. I've been in a minimalist mood lately, and it all started with crystal radios. Billy was asking me about really simple radio receivers, and I, of course, immediately talked about crystal radios and reminded him of our crystal radio experiments in London. Mike was involved by a long distance from Alaska. We used all kinds of things for detectors. We used the standard germanium commercial crystal diode, but we went beyond that, and then we used the standard galena, and we even used iron pyrite fool's gold, and had a lot of fun with it. In London, our little crystal radio picked up Radio Kismet, which was aimed at the South Asian community in London, and was transmitting in a variety of beautiful and exotic foreign languages. I think they were transmitting at one point in Urdu, but also probably Bengali and other languages. And so we used to enjoy listening to that. And after Billy asked me about crystal radios, I said, well, look, let's fire it up. So I reached into the junk box and pulled out what remained of our London crystal radio. It was in pretty good shape, and it's just maybe four parts. Let's see, it's got the coil. My coil is wound on an old Renew contact lens liquid bottle. There's the 365 picofarad variable capacitor that forms the LC circuit with the Renew bottle coil. Then there's the, I think it's 1N34A diode that we just mentioned. And the headsets, that's it, four. I have the little cat whisker Galena arrangement there, but I haven't used that so far here. But when I fired up the crystal radio, usually when I do this, usually there's sort of one really strong AM broadcast signal that we pick up, and that becomes the kind of the one station that we'll listen to. And it was really kind of cool here in Rome. I'm getting this thing going, and I'm tweaking it, I'm adjusting it, and I'm getting the antenna hooked up and everything. And all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but slowly, almost at first, imperceptibly, you get Gregorian chants, you know, the kind of the ancient heavenly sounding Gregorian chants coming through. And I knew right away that we had that we were tuned in to Vatican Radio. You know, the Vatican, we're very close to Vatican City here, but I don't think what we were picking up was actually transmitted from Vatican City. I think it's transmitted from their medium wave and short wave antenna site north of Rome. But they have a very strong signal here. They're on 1530 kilohertz in Rome on AM, and come through quite nicely on the crystal radio. And I must say, there's something kind of appropriate about tuning in an ancient crystal radio and getting a Gregorian chants from Vatican Radio. So that's what we were listening to here a little bit this week. On the blog, I put up a little report about the crystal radio thing, and then still in the minimalist mood, the next day I moved on to a project that had been kind of put on the shelf here, and that's my one FET MFP 102 single FET transceiver. I've yet to make a contact with this. A few months back, I was fooling around with it, and I got the receiver working kind of minimally, and the transmitter transmitting, but I've never made a contact. There's a fella here in Rome who's a CW operator who has agreed to help me try to schedule and make at least one contact with it. But then I said, oh, okay, let's see if I can work on this thing before we actually reach the point of trying to make the contact. So I started poking around, trying to get the receiver to work a little bit better and trying to see... the other thing I was trying to do is trying to determine why this rig was such a tremendous consumer of MPF 102 FETs. This thing, it seemed like I used up an FET every time I used this rig, and I thought, I had all kinds of theories about why. I thought it was because instead of using a standard four-pole double-throw switch, I was using a four-pole double-throw relay, and I thought that the kind of the voltage spikes from the coil in the relay were taking out the JFETs. That was a good theory, and I put a diode across the coil, and I put a capacitor across the coil. This is a standard trick that you could use so that when that relay opens or closes, whatever voltage spike in there goes through the diode and not through your circuitry. Quite a bit of basic electronic physics involved in how that, what happens with the power stored in that coil, the relay coil, and you could really mess up. I've messed up a lot of circuits. I've killed a lot of any 602 chips because of those voltage transients coming off of a relay coil. So believe me, guys, put a diode across that coil with a little capacitor there. But anyway, this thing was still eating up FETs. I have a whole lot of them here. They're pretty cheap. I've got a big box of them. But still, it didn't seem right that I should be having to replace the FET every time I use this transceiver. It's pretty bad. So anyway, I started looking at it a little bit more carefully, and I figured out what was going on. And what was happening is on the when I first powered the thing up, there would, before the relay would kick over, because I have it rigged so that the relay has to be engaged to have it in receive mode. So in other words, when you turn it on, it's normally in, if there's a second or half a second when it's in transmit mode. And I had, because I hadn't been paying too much to attention to the transmitter, I had the variable resistor, the pot that sets the bias on the transmitter, set way too high. So when I initially powered this thing up, for half a second or so, would be in transmit mode with some ungodly, you know, voltage, 5 volts or so, on the gate of the FET. And I think that was enough to send a real surge of current through this thing, and I think I was just burning them up that way. So anyway, even though I haven't been messing with the transistor yet, I went back there and carefully adjusted the voltage on the gate, and there you have it. I'm no longer massacring 102 JFETs here. But that still doesn't get us away from the main theme of this discussion, and that is my theory that while crystal radios may be from heaven, regens, and I know I'm going to offend some people here, I know there's people who love them, but regens are from the other place. Every time I go through this, I go through this every year or so, I'll see some circuit out there that's just so beautifully simple, and I'll say, oh wow, I got to build that thing. I'm doing it right now with the ET1, and then I build it, and then as I start to operate the thing, I start remembering why Armstrong went beyond the regen, why Armstrong saw the need to develop the superhead, to move beyond the blooper. The blooper is what they used to call them, you know, the blooper. The blooper doesn't really sound good. It's not even really. I suppose there's an element of affection in there. But blooper, it doesn't sound great, you know? It doesn't sound like a superhead. Anyway, I completely understand why Armstrong moved to the superhead. And I also thank Wes Hayward for pointing out in his famous QST article in 1968 about the double sideband, a neglected technique. Because believe me, after you mess around with a regen for a while, you find yourself yearning for the simplicity and ease of operation of a beautiful direct conversion receiver or a superhead. But if you're going to go with one, transistor, then pretty much the only way to do the receiver is as a regen. And that's the price you pay for the one transistor thing. So anyway, I've got it working. It's transmitting. I think it transmits about 10 milliwatts. And it's receiving. As a matter of fact, I just heard it make a sound over there. So we've got some sort of thunder. I think thunderstorm is rolling into Rome right now. We might have another thunderstorm special here. I don't know. It looks pretty ugly out there today. Anyway, crystal radios are from heaven, and regens are from the other place. I think I got the receiver working. We'll see. And I hope to report by the next edition of Solder Smoke that I've made my one and only QSO with this thing. Because at that point, it's going to go on the shelf and form part of the N2CQR Radio Museum. All right. Let's see. All right. So this has not actually been a really beautiful experience. You know, my wife tells me that she can tell if I'm having trouble at the workbench. She said it actually affects my mood. I know, incredible as that may seem, but it's true. And so I guess I was kind of grumpy yesterday. Oh, by the way, this is the Father's Day edition. That's right. Yeah, happy Father's Day to everybody out there. All right. Anyway, speaking of the regen experience was not really, I guess, what you'd call beautiful, but this brings me to a book that I want to recommend. And I came across this here in the English language section of one of Rome's many beautiful bookstores. And it's entitled The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments by George Johnson in the popular science category published by Vintage UK Random House. This is a really nice little book. It's a good book. I guess it's a good kind of take it to the beach or take it on vacation book for those of us who are interested in this kind of thing. And it deals with 10 of what the author considers the most kind of beautiful scientific experiments. There's some of them covered Galileo, the way things really move, and it talks about how Galileo actually did his experiments, not throwing rocks off the Tower of Pisa, but rolling smooth stones down inclines. William Harvey, Mysteries of the Heart. Isaac Newton's experiments on color. Kind of gross, because Newton was taking needles and sticking them back behind his own eyeballs. Don't try this at home, kids. Let's see. Luigi Galvani. This was good. Animal electricity. This is Galvani and Alessandro Volta arguing and fighting about what electricity is and using frog legs as electric detectors. You guys think you have problems with your test gear. Imagine if your only way to detect electricity was frog's legs. Man, Galvani had the knack. But really interesting, and also interesting discussions in there about how Volta, Alessandro Volta, made his first batteries. Great chapter on Michael Faraday called "Something Deeply Hidden." Good chapter on James Joule, "How the World Works." A really nice chapter on Michelson and Morley, and called "Lost in Space." And I guess my favorite chapter in the book is a chapter on Robert Millikan in the Borderland, in the famous Millikan oil drop experiment. The author, Mr. Johnson, he might not know it, but he seems to have the knack. And his chapter on Millikan is proof of this. He says, "On a Saturday morning in January, in search of the last piece of equipment I needed to persuade myself that electrons exist, I set out for the black hole, a post-apocalyptic junkyard. Everything goes in and nothing comes out, in Los Alamos, New Mexico, run by Edward B. Grothus, a former bomb maker and now an aging peace activist. The warehouse, converted from an old grocery store, is packed floor to ceiling with oscilloscopes, signal generators, Geiger counters, vacuum pumps, centrifuges, ammeters, ohm meters, voltmeters, cryogenic storage vessels, industrial furnaces, thermocouples, barometric gauges, transformers, typewriters, ancient mechanical calculators, more than 17,000 square feet of electronic and mechanical detritus cast off over the years by the National Laboratory where the Manhattan Project began." Man, we got to go there. Anyway, thanks for bringing that to us, George Johnson. Recommend the book. Good one for the beach. Let's see what else we have here. Oh, another book I just ordered because I had it and lost it. It's on its way. I ordered Arthur C. Clarke's book, Voices from the Sky, because there was a chapter in there about, there was a lot of funny chapters in there. There was one chapter about letters that his publisher sent back to kind of some of the crank scientific theories that came in. I'll share that with you hopefully when it arrives from Amazon or eBay or wherever I ordered it. Let's see, we talked about Regens from Hell. I mentioned before I-Zero Zulu Yankee, Gianfranco. Gianfranco is a good friend of mine here in Rome. We went out not long ago with some of the guys from who meet on 20 meter sideband each evening here at 8:30. And Gianfranco and I were talking about a variety of technical things, and then he followed up by sending me his QSL card. And then I wanted to get there's some thunder. Wow, could be a thunder edition here. Anyway, Gianfranco now runs a really interesting company called SPE, and I know this will be painful for some of you diehard, 100%, nothing but QRPers, but Gianfranco makes big, powerful linear amplifiers, really unusual design, and he's got a nice video on his website, and I put a link to it on mine. If you go to the blog, soldersmoke.blogspot.com, you'll find Gianfranco's amplifier video, so check it out. I thought it was really interesting. What else? Hold on. What else we got? Look at my scene. Regens from Hell. Oh, man. I got to make an announcement here, guys. The Solder Smoke store is going to have to close. Apparently, a lot of you guys weren't even aware that it was open. But I have up on the blog and that's why it's going to close. Anyway, I have up on the blog a link. If you go to the upper left, you'll see a nice Solder Smoke coffee mug there. And I put together this little store, virtual store, for on Cafe Press, and we have there a bunch of T-shirts, bumper stickers, coffee mugs. I thought this stuff would be popular, But I guess not, because nobody's going there and nobody's buying this stuff. And get this, here's the problem. It costs me $6 a month to keep this thing open. Cafe Press takes $6 off my credit card every month. And there have been very few months since the opening of the store where we sold more than $6 worth of stuff. So I'm not really much of a businessman, but I'm guessing that the problem here is the gazoutov is exceeding the gazinta. So anyway, if you want to buy any of the t-shirts, and this is not by any means a commercial pitch or a ploy to get people to buy more coffee mugs, because I'm gonna have to shut the thing down here in the next month or so, or else I'll spend the rest of my life losing $6 a month to Cafe Press. But if you want to get some of the t-shirts with our snappy sayings on them, you know, my other car was homebrewed from junk box parts, and I'd rather be home listening to solder smoke and drinking coffee in the shack, things like that. Check it out. Get it while you can, because I'm going to have to shut it down. I think they'll allow me to maintain a store with like one product or two products for free, but the overhead, the $6 a month rent on this virtual store is causing us to have a going out of business, not a going out of business sale, but a going out of business announcement. So check out the Cafe Press store. If you want to buy any of these fine products, I recommend that you do so within the next month or so, because after that, boom, no more solder smoke store. All right, guys, now it's time for
solder smoke mailbag.
I love them.
Indeed.
Yeah, solder smoke mailbag. All right. First, Paul has written to us telling us about a new kind of movement out there, and I'm going to have a link up this on the website. It's maker sheds, and it's electronic enthusiasts who get together and create kind of communal workbenches or workshops. And I got an update. Oh man, I'm gonna have to pause this right now. But anyway, I'll do that in a second, because there's a piece of mail that I missed and I want to get it in here. Hold on. But anyway, Paul was telling us, sent us some links to a BBC article about these electronic enthusiasts who create kind of communal maker sheds, and they share tools and equipment and test gear and technology, and they get together. They're not building ham radio gear. Oh man, did you guys get that one? Boom. Yeah, thunder. Hold on, let me open up the window here. Let's see if we get some of the rolling thunder. That was very popular last time we did this. Raining cats and dogs out there. Thunderstorms coming in. I hope I don't get zapped here as I record Solder Smoke 110. You guys hear a sudden kaboom and silence, you'll know that didn't go well. But anyway, this was a really interesting thing, and I think these folks, they don't quite have the knack, but they're getting there. And some of them, when you look at the video, you're wondering whether they really do have the knack or not, but I think there's some potential there. So I'm going to post the link to the video and on the blogspot, soldersmoke.blogspot.com blog. You could check it out. It's really kind of interesting that there's an interest in this kind of our electronics. I think some of these folks do have knack potential. So thanks for sending that along, Paul. Jonathan N0JMS has been reading Solder Smoke the book, which is of course is very very pleasing to me. And I was particularly pleased that Jonathan was focusing on the technical portions of the book, because each chapter has kind of a break from the memoir mode and discussions of technical topics and technical issues that I struggle to understand over the years. Anyway, Jonathan was asking about one that I really struggled with for a long time, and that's how junctions in semiconductors work, how the depletion zones are created, and how electrons, not so much electrons, but how the holes in the crystal lattice move, hole movement, the movement of holes always really caused me a lot of trouble when I was a kid trying to read the handbook, trying to understand how that transistor really worked. When they started talking about holes moving through the P-type material and moving into the depletion zone and moving across junctions, I had a tough time understanding the movement of holes. Was the atom moving? Was there a positive ion moving through there or something? What exactly was moving? Anyway, Jonathan had similar problems. I think many of you guys did, and he was kind enough to write in, and we had a little discussion about the junctions in bipolar transistors and how holes move through the P-type material. I wrote in the book that the guy who really explained this all to me was a British engineer named F.A. Wilson, who wrote a really wonderful book called Atoms to Amperes. And that was the source of a lot of the technical topics, or the source of the kind of the understanding that went into these sections of the book. So really glad to get some feedback on the technical portions of the book. Thanks for that, Jonathan. Along similar lines, I got a nice email here from Herb, WR9H. And I just thought I would drop you a note to say how much I enjoy your website and the book. I just finished reading the book and was amazed at how you've pondered the same electronics issues as myself. I spent an intense year trying to figure out what an electron was. It's what? Charge? I did the same thing with radio waves. What are they, and how can they travel through space? Next question. What is space? It certainly must be something, as mass and energy exist within it. I could add time to that list for space, but I think you know what would happen. Feynman's blind alleys. Hi. I have my local library searching for a copy of F.A. Wilson's From Atoms to Amperes. I look forward to reading it. I have read most of Feynman's stuff with varying degrees of comprehension. I have both SSDRA and the new EMRFD. I met KK7B at the 4 days in May gathering in Dayton. I would love to take his analog design course. It's amazing how your desire to become a radio wizard parallels mine. I started in the 1960s with a crystal set, moved to a cheap, not for me, communication receiver known as the Monarch Ham 1. I spent joyous evenings after school reading the handbook. I particularly liked Understanding Amateur Radio, as it was sort of a junior handbook. Yeah, I remember that one. I bought all the magazines, including every issue of Pop Electronics. I found an entire collection at a garage sale. Alas, they were lost in a basement flood. My beloved Ham 1 also. But I've recently bought another Ham 1. I digress. Herb continues. I have DeMaw, Hayward, Schrader, Fry, McElroy, Faraday, Maxwell, Feynman, Asimov, and many others as my heroes. I still have a picture of Armstrong as the leading page in my logbook. All right. I spent time contemplating resonance, modulation, transformers, transistor and tube bias, antennas. Still a bit of a mystery. The pushing soap bubble analogy for radio waves coming off is still my favorite. Straight keys, keyboards, SSB, AM, FM tuners. I would still spend hours studying schematics. I want to know what every component does. Those of you who read the book know that he's quoting Maxwell. Again, Bill, thanks for the site and the book. I want and need a sequel. All right. Well, like I said in the book, maybe later. That's what you have to sequel. Sequels always come later, right? All right. Speaking of books, Thad, AJ8T, sent a link to a really cool-looking book. It's in Italian, and it looks to be similar to mine in that it looks like it's put out, it's self-published by one of the new print-on-demand publishers. It's called Zen and the Art of Radio Telegraphy by Carlo Consoli, IK0YGJ. Those of you who are Italian readers, Michael Alpha Alpha 1 TJ, among them, I recommend Carlo's book. I haven't got it myself yet, but I'm going to pick it up. Looks really interesting, and it's really, really great that he was able to put this together. Zen and the Art of Radio Telegraphy by Carlo Consoli. George, GB3ODH, writes and reminds us about really, really minimalist radio, the carbon nanotube radios. Thanks for that, George. We talked about this a bit, I think, a while back. But if you guys are interested, just wiki, Google, carbon nanotube radios. Really interesting stuff there. Paul, K3PG, writes in about the an article, a rather unfortunate article in the Washington Times on the whole shortwave radio spy number station thing. And I read the Washington Times article, and it was really, I'm sure this drove a lot of people nuts, because as they were describing the number station and the shortwave radio and spy communication, they just paused and said something like, "And there are more than 600,000 amateur radio operators out there in the United States." Oh, man. A couple more articles like that, and they'll be kicking our doors down, taking away our AT-1s and our Helicrafter HT-37s. Gosh, oh, man. Tough times for ham radio operators. All right. Almost forgot, but I wanted to make sure we got in here a report from our man in Dover. Our club in Dover, the Dover Construction Club. Nigel, M0NDE, sent in an update from the White Cliffs. "Good morning, Bill. I'm pleased to tell you I ordered your book and it arrived here in Dover in under 2 weeks from the time of ordering. I've put it away until my holiday at the end of July when it will be read. I am looking forward to it. This weekend I'm off work, but taking an early boat out to Calais." It's nice when you can say that. "I'm taking an early boat out to Calais. I'm riding my motorbike down to Cambria, about 90 kilometers southeast from Calais. I'm meeting up with members from three local clubs and hope to hear more of their planned special event station to be set up at Sangatte at the end of July." Nigel's involved with a special event operation there in the English Channel, commemorating the anniversary of the first airplane crossing of the channel by Bleriot. Nigel continues, "Construction-wise, I am progressing with the SDR Soft Rock 6.3. I have completed the power supply section and testing showed no errors. Merv, also of the club, is much further on. He has almost completed the population of the main board and has just to complete the PA and filter boards." All right, good luck to the SDR constructors there. Nigel continues, "Ian is working on power supplies for our trailer, which serves as an operating station. It is made from a cut-down caravan. We have obtained some old jail cell-type batteries from old shop alarms, and after testing, the best have been selected." Oh man, been there, done that. Ian plans to make up a tray with several batteries linked to provide power for field days. Tony is between projects. The receiver project, having taken many years to complete, is finally finished. Yay! Three cheers for Tony. I guess he is building up his strength in readiness for the next 14-year project. He is planning a new aerial for his home to satisfy neighbors and his wife. We are planning a stealthy vertical based around a 7-meter fishing pole. Been there, done that too. Those fishing poles, I tell you, they're great. Almost invisible. Get one of those collapsing kind, telescoping. I downloaded SS-109 but have not had time to turn on the iPod. A 12x12 workshop is under construction in my garden to hold my lathe and welders and etc. Yeah, you know, you got the lathe, you got the welders, you gotta do some downloading, you gotta do some workshop construction there. Completion of this new workshop should be in the next 2 weeks. Another shed for the sanctuary of a NAC victim. It was given full approval by Michelle. I guess she wants the welders out of the house. You know, that's an interesting idea. You know, if you want to get family support, for the construction of an actual shack or shed out in the back, one of the great way to do it is to point out that this is a good way to get the welders out of the house. Yeah, you know, get that welding gear out in the backyard. Norman has made no progress on his 80-meter SSB, but has been planning the removal of his 8x12 wooden shed. Work starts next week on its demolition. It will be replaced this year by a block-built workshop. We think we can squeeze in a 10x14 workshop again with XYL approval. Progress indeed. That's all for now. Thanks for the nice update from Dover in regards to all the fellows. Good luck with the new shacks and sheds and projects, and thanks for writing in, Nigel. Thanks. Bill, K2RXQ, he wrote in another nice article, nice email, very similar in tone to Herb's, and said he really identified with the stories from the book. And one of the nicest bits of feedback that I've gotten on the book, and I really appreciated this, came from Jim AL7FS up in Alaska, and he talked about how he could really identify with it. And he said, and I found this really touching, and I think it was very sincere, that when he read the preface, he actually got a bit choked up by it. And, you know, it sounds kind of corny, but Jim, I occasionally got a bit choked up as I was writing it, because it's, you know, ham radio and home brewing and melting solder and all this, it really is a very important part of our lives. Most of us have been at it for a long, long time. And it's something that connects us with our childhoods, and it is an emotional thing. So, Jim, thanks for noting that you did get a bit choked up by Solder Smoke, A Global Adventure in Radio Electronics. Guys, that brings us to the end of edition 110. You could tell I'm a bit choked up here. Thanks for listening. Have a great Father's Day and a good early part of the summer. Catch you in a couple weeks. 7-3 from Rome.